FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
This episode of the Financial Survival Network is brought to you in part by Sandstorm Gold Royalties. Sandstorm Gold Royalties is a different kind of gold company. They purchase royalties on select mining operations and receive a percentage of the revenue in return. Sandstorm now has a portfolio of over 185 gold royalties around the world. See how gold royalties differ from other gold mining investments at sandstormgold.com. That's sandstormgold.com. Sandstorm Gold Royalties trades on the TSX as SSL and on the New York Stock Exchange American as SAND.
Welcome. You are listening to the Financial Survival Network, and hopefully my sound has been improved. I've done some improvements to the system. Have a couple of things that are going bad, and I have to replace them. I've ordered the parts, so let me know what you think of the sound quality. Very important. Pride myself on high production values and giving you the best possible show that I possibly can. Hey, as always, we invite you to be a part of the show, and you do that by emailing kl@carrylutz.com. Well, our old friend Bob Hoy is back with us. Bob, you've made some pretty remarkable calls. You were calling for dollar strength almost from the instant that the financial crash occurred. You've been spot on, especially the last 4 years. And now it looks like the barbarous relics of precious metals, you know, I'm talking primarily about gold, to a lesser degree silver, they are making a move. So it would appear, just looking at the prices today on our good friends Kitco, gold's up $580 the ounce to right around $1,290.50. Silver right at $1,568. They're both getting close to breaking whole numbers, if you believe in such things. Not that it's a major indicator. It's a confirming indicator in my book. Anyway, Bob, it's great to have you back on. And you wrote an article on Canada Free Press, which I don't think really comes from Canada, but you could use a free press over there with everything that's going on. And your erstwhile prime minister is really got something for brains there that I don't want to repeat on the show, because we are a family show after all, but not the brightest bulb on the tree for sure. But hey, it's been a while, so welcome back.
Yeah, it's good to be with you. Markets are fascinating. As you know, I've been a financial historian for a long time, and there are major patterns out there that we watch. And one of the things that got us back into the gold stocks beginning in early November was that as the bubble ends, it then releases a new bull market for gold. And this doesn't rely on sort of having gold itself go up in U.S. dollars. What it is the real price of gold. And how I got onto this was a long time ago when I was doing all the historical research. And but this was so long ago, Carrie, I was by hand dividing the price of gold annually by the consumer price index and the senior currency back to 1700. Of course, earlier it was London and sterling was the main action. And then since the early 1930s, the U.S. dollar has been the senior currency. And the pattern is straightforward. When you're in a financial mania, which we have been in for a number of years, the real price of gold goes down. Mm-hmm. Because everything else is partying. You got better base metal prices. You got better crude oil prices, which means higher energy costs. And right. And the metal itself, in senior currency terms, dollar terms, doesn't really do well at all. So this we expected to continue until the great financial mania blew out. And we were positive on the stock market through most of last year. As a matter of fact, in the hit down to February, we brought out our friends of the bull market, which would be base industrial commodities plus the yield curve and credit spreads, and they would then be positive through to mid-year. And we used the term sunshine. And then in August, it would turn to twilight. And then after August, there was the probability that we would go into the twilight zone. You'll remember that very good series of plays on TV from years ago, written and produced by Rod Serling. So we, beginning in September, the stock market rolled over into the twilight zone and is in what we consider to be a lengthy, let's put it this way, a severe bear market. And it was justifiably earned. Valuations were at the moon. At various times you had momentum right up there, as good as it ever gets. And plus the timing. So then the other part was that gold's real price, as deflated by the CPI, it soared all the way up until 2011, making that, you know, a real bull market for the sector. But of course, it went crazy. And then this is where we use the silver-gold ratio. And in a bull market for the precious metals, we all know that silver outperforms gold, but we just do a simple one on it with the daily RSI. And in, I think, April or May of 2011, it got, the RSI got up to 92. Really? And the only time it had been there in the past was in January of 1980 at the top of that market. So we advised that the situation was dangerous and be prepared for a bear market in the sector. So then what we're bullish on now is that this real price of gold is deflated by the CPI. It had come down all this time, but we can say for the last year and a half, it looks like it's trying to base, which is good, because if you, we did, as I said, we did the same research against the great bubble of 1929, the one before that, 1873, and then there was the 1825 bubble, and going all the way back to the original South Sea bubble of 1720, the pattern is there. Gold down in real terms, and gold stocks underperforming all the bubble stocks, which we have had. So now this is where we are positioned in November for a probable long-term bull market, which would not be based upon the old story of inflation and the U.S. dollar going down and the price of gold going to, who knows, 10,000. But it would be based upon what happened in the 1930s, where until Roosevelt raised the price, it stayed at 20.67 announced till the end of 1932, and the real price went up. And if you take Homestake as the major producer then, their earnings went down with the bubble of 1929. The stock got hit hard with the crash, but you could buy it all the way through 1930-31 at, say, $9 a share. And then by the end of 1932, before gold's price was changed, it was up something like 130% when the rest of the market was tanking. And then the and the earnings were up something in that order as well, because their costs went down. Energy costs went down. Equipment costs went down. Base metal mines, copper mines were shutting down. So then labor was available, and that's just the way it works. So then eventually Homestake, well, it went up to the $60, $65, I think it was. And in those days, the gold miners paid out most of what they earned and by way of dividend. So on your $9 accumulation purchase in 1930 and 1931, it went to $65 and then was paying $4.50 a share dividend through the 1930s. So the prosperity in the gold sector was outstanding. And it has been on each of the long post-bubble contractions that we can see going all the way back for 300 years. So this is what we're looking for, Kerry, is the sector won't be driven by the popular idea that the dollar is going to get hit and the gold price is going to go up. It'll be due to profitability in the sector coming back. And of course, you know what that's going to do. If you've got operating mines becoming profitable or more and more profitable, then the valuations on exploration properties will be becoming more valuable as well. So it's going to be very exciting times when it gets going, but it's going to be vulnerable like this. The decline in the big stock market has got the Dow down something like 20%. Mm-hmm. But we don't think that's finished. You'll have some oversolds, but here was another classic pattern is on all five of the previous great financial bubbles, including the one South Sea one in 1720.
Yeah, I remember
it
well.
Suffered. Yeah.
Learning about it. I wasn't there for it, but learning about the South Sea bubble.
Neither was I. But so. they all got hit in the fall. Mm. And each one of them, it follows a pattern. Heavy liquidation down to late October, which was the case in 1873 and 1929, and this fall. Rebound in November, then down and doing a very big test of the selling pressures. And one of the bubbles, which was a very big one, was 1825. And on that one, the final selling pressures didn't clear until the end of the year. So the people went through a horror show Christmas with the financial markets. And then you would have some trading around. But each of these post-bubble contractions have had very common items. We can get copper. We got that back to 1830. And deflate it, so where it goes up with the stock boom, it goes down with the contraction afterwards. So weakening copper prices in here is another industrial commodities, like the rest of the base metals and plus crude oil, are symptomatic of a post-bubble contraction. And then the one we started with is that you take gold's real price and deflated by the consumer price index or the producer price index, which used to be called the wholesale price index, gold outperforms. So we're just waiting for it to see if it just breaks a little more. But it's one of those frustrating things, Kerry. You can only look at it once a month after they post the you can look at it, but it's not significant until they post each month's CPI.
It's like paint drying. It's like watching paint dry. Very frustrating.
Yeah. You got to be patient when you're going on about the real price of gold.
Yes.
So this has been regular. Each of the great gold rushes have occurred at a depression bottom. 1895 was a depression bottom, and that's when you had the Klondike gold discovery and gold rush. And what helps makes it work is that at a depression bottom, you have high unemployment and you have the price of gold, real price, high. So people go looking for it. It didn't happen in the 1940s because there was a war on. But in the 1930s, yes, you had gold rushes everywhere. then the depression bottom, as I mentioned, 1895, then going, oh yeah, that was also the gold discoveries at Melbourne in Australia. And then, of course, the 1840s was the gold discoveries in California, and that was at a depression bottom. And it's the way Mother Nature works the financial system, and in a bubble, everybody goes crazy for financial instruments, and there's an expansion of the normal items of credit, bonds, notes, all that sort of stuff. But then also you have the invented products, all these derivatives in the credit markets. And everybody gets long this garbage, and then it goes bad. So you then, this is where you can, this is why it's reasonable to call it a credit contraction, mm-hmm. because the weird invented credit just disappears, and junk bonds, the prices go down to who knows what. So you have a credit contraction. But what happens with that is that the real price of gold goes up. The miners produce more of it. And with, of course, with economists all officially hating gold, but it gets into the system and it begins to re-liquefy a financial system that is normal instruments are contracting. And it's the way Mother Nature does it. So where in at the height of a bull market in gold, like 2011, there was forecast, oh, it's going to go to 10,000.
Yeah, I was one of those believers, I will confess. And I was absolutely wrong.
What happens is that in the post-bubble deflationary depression contraction world, the real price, that's the equivalent. And let's put it this way, Carrie. The stocks will go to the equivalent of $10,000 gold without gold having to go to $10,000. All it has to do is
Well,
once it breaks out here, which I think somewhere over the next 4 or 5 months, it will break out, the real price. And on my theory, that'll improve operating margins and improve the valuations for exploration properties, and away we go into a bull market for the sector. You can't quite call it a new bull market yet, but we've had a nice base in the sector. It was after it was severely beat up, and it'll take some work in here because you still have the selling threats from the big stock market going down. And no matter how good gold the sector may be, it's going to have to kind of trade it from overbought to oversold, which we work on. You would have a core position, of course,
sure,
and then trade the ones that are tradable. But I would also say that one should be positioned in exploration stocks as well. I've always liked that. I mean, I originally did a degree in geophysics and spent some great summers in mining exploration work. And then I had to get a job for the winter after I graduated. And that was in the middle of Vancouver Island where it rained and snowed a lot. But it was on a good discovery. That was a massive sulfide base metals deposit. And I saved up $500 and bought some stock. I think it was around $1.17. And I came out at 5.25 thinking I was a genius. It went to 7.25. But that's what got me out of the bush and into the investment business. And it's been fascinating to be in the business, but this is where I've always got some regard, or actually a lot of regard, for the exploration side. And originally, a lot of exploration in the precious metals was done by some of the big firms on grassroots exploration, major programs. Placer, the old company, was very good at that.
Sure.
But then after some of these big ones kind of ran into troubles, there's been a a number of geologists who have learned the investment business and stocks and geology and exploration, and there have been some terrific companies develop over the last 30 years that I've seen, and there will be more. So the whole format for exploration is more or less gone out of the hands of the majors and into the hands of juniors. That's not quite the right name, because many of them have very talented management, both in the ability to do the geology and also the ability to run the company and also the ability to raise money. So it's going to be a great sector.
All right. Well, that's sounding pretty good. So stock markets, we can expect to go down. Is it just going to be the air being let out of the balloon? They just realize they can't do it anymore. What's going to happen there?
We've got one of our technical side is just a trading model that we've developed over and using it for years. That in a bull market for stocks or a flat to rising market, it gives the buys. Like we call it the springboard buy, which then helps you buy the dips in a bull market. But now we've amended that slightly so that now we call it the bearish springboard, where it helps you sell the rallies. Now, that's on the big stock market, regular stocks. And, of course, the opposite should come into play on the precious metal sector, where you will be playing the long side and buying the dips. But, you know, here's another old story, Kerry. When I started in the investment business, it was 1963, and that was with then Canada's premier investment dealer. I was there as sort of a trainee assistant mining and petroleum analyst.
You wore a lot of hats back in the day.
Hmm?
You wore a lot of hats back then.
Those days. This was in the head office in Toronto, and then you'd have a strong week for the industrial stocks. The Toronto gold mining stocks would be down, even on a day-to-day basis. So I got puzzled by that, and then I talked to one of the head of equity trading, and I said, "Well, why does this happen, that you have a strong day for industrials and weak golds? Then it goes the other way." And he says, "Sonny, that's the way it works." So this is then, that might have been the old hangover from ages ago when the gold stocks were trading well. But I think that this opposite thing should come in, where there could be times when you could have gold stocks up on a day when the industrial type of stocks would be down. But at the moment, we're in a liquidity problem, and that may not work for a while, but it could come in. Now, what's missing in this declining stock market so far is that there's been no real it's been bloody, but there's been no real serious panic. And we got to thinking about that the other day. And what's been missing, of course, is that there's no announcements of defaults or insolvencies.
Right.
So let's go back to 2007, where the yield curve changed in May of 2007. And then in June, the credit spread started to widen. And it was in early June where it was discovered that Bear Stearns was in a serious problem, and there was excitement about that. But then you went right through until September of 2008, when then it was Lehman Brothers was in serious problems. So there was disaster. But what we've been talking about is, in the last few weeks, the moves in the interest rate markets with credit spreads, which is the difference between high-grade and low-grade bonds, And then also the yield curve, which is the difference between long-dated and short-dated bonds in the same, like treasuries, that there's been enough change there that the credit markets are like the stock market. Everybody gets leveraged. And then when it's a one-way market, and it has been, everybody's on the wrong side. And then as it's changed, as it has done, the changes really began in August and into September in these, in the curve and in spreads. So when those changes come in, there are people, I would suggest now, who are seriously offside. Mm-hmm. So I think there's been almost enough change that it could push off some insolvencies. But we haven't seen that. So who knows? Maybe it might take yet more damage to the curve and spreads before you see some the discovery of defaults or insolvencies. And I hate to talk about dismal things like that, but we have to face it. So the senior indexes are down some 20%. There's been sectors worked over worse than that. There's some big, big stocks that are down 50%. But there's no panic headlines that I can see. And that will rest upon the announcement of the discovery of some defaults. So I'm not a doomster, but one has to realize the way these financial markets work once you get into a contraction. And
we're there.
But I love it. It's fascinating, Kerry, to see all of this work out similar to previous bubbles in the past.
Hey, so history doesn't repeat itself, it rhymes, eh?
When you put a price to it, it gets pretty close to repeating. Gosh, there's another historical one we could review, which is that, and this one I discovered myself decades ago, is that you knew about 1929. Mm-hmm. And then I realized that there was a huge commodity boom that ended in 1920. Mm-hmm. So then I looked back, and the South Sea bubble, which blew out in 1720, and then I got a price index for a CPI, price of consumables for England, and going back there, and if there wasn't a huge boom in commodities in 1711. So 9 years later, you had the South Sea bubble blow out in 1720. And then the other ones, we can, like in the with the Civil War in the U.S., the commodities and the CPI inflation got up and blew out and completed in 1864, and the stock bubble completed in September of 1873. So then, of course, in 1920 was a huge boom in commodities, and then one can read about that scared the hell out of the Federal Reserve guys, so they spent the 1920s with easier money policy than they should have, because they were trying to prevent and basic commodities from declining, but not understanding the way a financial market works, a bubble works, that they were then feeding speculation in the stock market. Now, for the this time around on that pattern, the commodities had their really big boom in 2008 when crude oil got up to 147. Hmm. And then 9 years later, at the end of 17 or January of 2018, that was the peak for the New York Stock Exchange composite.
Right.
But Kerry, gets even more interesting, this 9 year thing, where in 1920, you know, the month that the commodities had their peak. And of course, we know the month when the stock market had its peak in September. So that was 9 years and 5 months from the commodity boom, then crash, and then stock market boom and top. And this time, from June of 2008, it was 9 years and 7 months. Right. Remarkable so stuff, isn't it?
10 years. Like, I heard another one that generally in years that end with sevens, you have major peaks in markets. We go back to 2017, arguably, to 2007, 1997, yeah. 1987 for sure, 1967. I don't remember 77, but that peak, it's, you know, also another one is whenever unemployment hits 3.8 in the United States, that's a peak. And we're kind of looking at a recession,
yep.
Right?
Yep. You can just look at it in the charts, and it's fascinating to watch. Certainly on the peak in commodities in 08, we were just focusing on that, the fact that the credit markets changed in May, June 2007, and we were heading for a cyclical contraction. And it wasn't until last March, I guess it was, that I looked at the nine-year thing, and I said, this is working out. So in August, a year ago, it was the nine-year thing, watch out. And then on October the 5th edition of 2017, and concluded that the whole world was going to get bubbled, including the Dow Jones. And then we noted the number of examples where a really good speculation had blown out in the December-January window, and of course included gold in 1980. The Nikkei, that Tokyo speculation concluded right at the last trading day of 1989. And then 1973, whoa, boy, that was 73-74 was a bad bear market. That one peaked in January. So that was our target, certainly for the .com or for the Bitcoin amazing phenomenon, that probably December, January. And then it did come in on December the 19th. Our technical stuff came up with what we call a sequential sell on the weekly, and we hadn't had one of those in 2 years. So our conclusion on the Bitcoin stuff was that the correction would be the most severe in 2 years. And then the other one was that the stock market peak in January with the New York Stock Exchange composite, the weekly RSI on that one got up to 89. It was very high. And to give you an idea how high it was, the NASDAQ composite in the crazy .com bubble got up to 84. And here you had the whole NYSE composite up to an RSI of 89. That's what I said, that you had momentum like you wouldn't believe.
Never saw. And Bob, so, we got to kind of wrap up now. So we're looking for further, collapsing stock market, higher metals prices, eventually higher metal stock prices once they get separated or decoupled from the broader averages. And
the precious metal side, gold mining is the one industry that you can forecast that will do well in a post-bubble contraction,
right,
mainly because it's done it five times in history. So
always.
We like the sector. You got to be careful.
Sure.
And there'll be some good trades.
Absolutely. Hey, well, we appreciate you coming on as always. Where's the best place to find you these days, Bob?
Well, same old thing. Just do bobhoye.com, BOBHOYE. You can Google the name. And also, as I said, bobhoye.com. And it gets into our institutional advisors and charts and trading and all the services that we provide. And I'm going to wish our listeners a very prosperous new year.
Absolutely. Well, thanks so much. Hey, questions, comments, be a part of the show and write to Bob. Care of me, KL@KerryLutz.com. If you are listening on YouTube, please like, share, subscribe. And if you're just listening to the podcast or any other channel, just share us with somebody. It really helps the show a lot, helps us grow, helps us get to more of you, and hopefully will help people when this crash inevitably arises, which it's going to. Nothing is going to stop it. Bob, we'll talk to you again real soon. Thanks so much.
Very good, Kerry.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.